You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Diamondbacks baseball.
And he corks one way back, and it is gone!
The D-backs BP show.
Fly ball to left, hit pretty well by Lamb at the wall, it's gone!
Diamondbacks radio network.
There's a shot to center field, Parr on the run, can't get it, he gets by him, all the way to the wall, bounces more towards center, Marte turns second, he heads for third, Tony Parasekas racing into the plate, here comes the throw, it's high, he is safe!
D-backs BP show.
And welcome to our program tonight. Our producer-engineer, as always, is Leo Gilmartin. Our technical director, Luke Robbins, with Steve Berthume, the television voice of the Arizona Diamondbacks. I'm Mike Farron. And guys, today was a pretty big day in that Major League Baseball made a financial proposal to the Players Association in an effort to try and get the 2020 season restarted sometime towards the beginning of July. There are some details, and we'll get more into it with Evan Drellick in just a little bit. But, Bert, after last week when we were talking about some of the health protocols that they were attempting to work through, it seems that there has been progress but no agreement on that front as of yet, and now they're going to need to spend the next week to 10 days working through this financial component.
Yeah, now we're getting into the economics here, Mike. And as Jeff Passan, who we had on the show, was it last week or the week before? As he wrote the other day on ESPN, one high-ranking official said everything is going to happen next week, meaning this week, and now we're really getting into the nitty-gritty and the reaction from, based on everything we've seen on the reports on Twitter and people like Jeff Passan at ESPN, Bob Nightingale, USA Today. It didn't go over all that well today, but I think that was to be expected.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, Leo, is, and I think Bert made this point a couple of weeks ago as we started to get into a little bit further into the financial weeds on this stuff, that, you know, all of this is negotiation, and I don't think anybody anticipated that it was going to be wrapped up this afternoon. I think if you did, I've got some property near Yuma right on the ocean that I'd like to sell to you. But I do think that, you know, even if you hear things like privately, the Players Association was disappointed or discouraged by it, I mean, this is all part of negotiation, and there's a lot of money that's at stake between both sides. It's going to take a while to work out.
Oh, no doubt. It's and we know. We've said on this show several times over the last few weeks that we knew it was going to be a roller coaster. We knew there was going to be some bumps along the way, but my biggest takeaway from today is it's a start. You know, the sides are talking, and you have to start somewhere, and it's a start. So we'll see how it plays out.
I mean, if you've ever applied for a job before and they've come in really low, you've come in really high, you know how difficult it is to just kind of, winnow it down for sure. So I think that's a big chunk of what we're going to deal with. I think you'll hear, you know, far more specifics from Evan Drellick and The Athletic coming up in just a little bit as well as to what's going on with proposals, where things stand after, you know, hour one or hour two of negotiations and where we could go from there. But this week there was other news surrounding the Diamondbacks, Burton, that Salt River Fields and Chase Field both opened up for players to begin working out in the anticipation that the 2020 season will be played. And both sides still would like to play a 2020 season, so that's good. But that's one of the things that we've seen is guys are starting to make their way over to the ballparks to try and get some work in, and individual workouts, or at least in smaller groups, rather than trying to lift weights in their garage.
Which we always encourage, by the way. Torey Lovello, Mike, addressed that on a conference call with reporters actually just a few hours ago. And Torey said they're doing this in almost in sections. They have very small groups of hitters and very small groups of pitchers that are going to Chase Field, all scheduled on different days. So they've got it all worked out so there's not more than a handful of people there at one time. Torey said he does not go down there because they have working coaches who are overseeing the workouts, and he doesn't want to sort of step on their toes. He wants them to be as involved as possible. But they do have eyes on these guys, and it's small groups working out on a predetermined schedule, so, and everybody's keeping a respectful distance and everything like that. You're trying to make it as safe as possible. But it was great to hear that they are, in a sense, up and running, at least in the smallest sense. So that's certainly a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique situation, Leo, in that there's just not, I mean, we haven't seen anything like this before. I guess the closest we come to is the ramp up after the 81 strike.
Yeah, uncharted territory. It's new for everyone, but it's good to see ball players in ballparks, I guess, even if it's small numbers and everyone's being smart about it. And it's got to feel good for them, like you said, to stop working out in a garage or in a backyard and getting in. And I'm not sure. Do we know, Mike, you may know better than I do, certainly. Have all teams started to do this in some level? And we're very fortunate. We get both our spring training and our ballpark here. So,
yeah, it's not every team has done it. Most are trying to put together plans. I think the Mariners had something like 9 guys out at the Peoria complex over the course of the last couple of days. The Tampa Bay Rays had a workout yesterday at Tropicana Field, where they had, again, a small group. I think Kevin Cash, their manager, was there for that. The Marlins were the first to open their facility in Jupiter, Florida, for players. That was at the end of last week. So there's a handful of teams that have done this to this point, and I think it just depends on where players are and what makes the most sense. And I think you're right. I mean, there's an advantage here and the guys can be spread out because both facilities are in Phoenix. But I think you'll see it where, you know, as guys start matriculating more to Seattle, because they likely haven't gotten there from the season yet. Like the Mariners, for example, will have both facilities open maybe for a short time. But it's only open to players who are currently on the 40-man roster. So it's not like minor leaguers can go there and work out, or any former major leaguers that have signed minor league deals as well.
And the advantage, as you guys know, that we have, and Torrey mentioned this with reporters today, was that so many of the players live here in the area that they're able to cycle through on their scheduled days and take part in these workouts. So that's sort of a built-in advantage for the Diamondbacks. There were 2 other minor news items that Torrey addressed today, guys. He said for himself he's very optimistic things are trending in the right direction. But as we know, Torrey is the most optimistic of people anyway.
Yes, he is.
It's good to hear that Torrey Lovello. Anything positive about this is something we'll take. He was asked about Starling Marte,
yeah,
who recently lost his wife. Just a horrible story. But they've been texting back and forth, and Torrey says that Starling is not with the team now. He's not here. But he will be when things are officially given the green light to get underway. So he's working out on his own. He does plan to return to our facility here on time. If and when things do get settled. So it looks like Starling Marte is on schedule for an on-time arrival here, and considering what he's been through here, maybe that's a good thing for him. I'm sure he's anxious to sort of find some comfort with his teammates and get into some kind of routine.
You know, and with that in mind, because obviously he and Ketel Marte will be coming from the Dominican Republic, late last week, the acting secretary of the Homeland Security signed an order that allows professional athletes to re-enter the United States, even if they may be coming from areas where there have been quarantines or there are travel restrictions. And so that's something to keep in mind. It was something that kind of came out towards the end of last week, and I'm not sure if you guys had heard anything about that, but just in one of those, everybody's concerned about getting everybody together and ready for, you know, spring training, or in the case of, you know, the NHL today announcing what their very cool 24-team playoff may end up looking like, players in from other countries. It does seem like the government is certainly working with the sports leagues in that regard, and so that shouldn't be an issue for players that have gone home to wait out this quarantine period. So,
you know, it will be interesting, Mike, to see how many concessions that, before we get into the economics here, and I know we have Evan coming up, the players, it seemed like, gave a fairly significant amount of pushback on part of the health plan in terms of the everyday maintenance, things like showers, hot tubs, cold tubs, everything they need to maintain their bodies over the course of what may be an 80 or 100 game season at the most. So it seems like there's some room for concessions on ownership side in terms of some of the health protocols.
Yeah, I think some of that, and I get a little deeper into it, some of that would come with more testing, I believe. At least that's my understanding of it. So the plan as it sits right now would call for frequent testing, but not daily testing. And that would be one of the trade-offs. Now, the question is, is that a bit of a moving target? You know, is there going to be enough, even though Major League Baseball has taken and basically transformed its facility where it does the drug testing into a COVID testing facility, you know, there's 24-hour turnaround time on all of these tests. And so being able to have point-of-care access would be, you know, very important, but you're also dealing with municipalities that haven't gotten there yet. That said, 6 weeks from now, testing is going to look a lot different than it did today, just like it looks a lot different today than it did 6 weeks ago in terms of the availability. So I wonder if that's one of those things that it's like, as we get more testing, we very well may end up with something that resembles, you know, more high fives in the dugout than guys sitting 6 feet apart. So
I'm not sure there's such a thing as a stationary target in all of this, whether it's health concerns,
no.
Economic concerns, everything is just so fluidly day to day and week to week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've said it several times. There's so many moving parts, and it's hard because you live in the day. You know, you live like, what happened today? What have we heard today? What's the news today? But the tough thing is you have to project it all. You have to see, okay, how's this really going to play out? How things, you know, whether it be the testing, you know, how you have to be able to project that, and that's why they're talking to the health experts. And they have all the people that they need to canvas to make sure that they're getting the best projections they can to see if this is all going to be possible.
We'll talk a little bit more about the labor issues that are facing Major League Baseball and the Players Association next. Evan Drellick from The Athletic will join us. This is the D-backs BP Show.
Diamondbacks Baseball. Diamondbacks Baseball. This is the Diamondbacks BP Show. Diamondbacks Radio Network.
Well, today, Major League Baseball made a financial proposal to its Players Association with regards to the 2020 season. The man who's been covering a good chunk of this covers the business of baseball for The Athletic. It's Evan Drellick, who is kind enough to spend a few moments with us this evening. Drells, first and foremost, what was your reaction to the news today? What can you tell us about what happened today?
Well, in some way, it's what you would expect in a negotiation where the league is going to start off somewhere that's probably not where it's going to ultimately end up. The reaction in the player and agent community has been particularly strong, and Ken Rosenthal and I are actually writing our story for tonight right now. And that's an interesting tactic that the league would propose something that arguably you would know the union, if it won't reject out of hand, will see as negative, because the feeling is that the tier system that they proposed today, where higher paid players are taking larger cuts, is the kind of thing that the players and their agents and the union are looking at as potentially divisive. And the whole idea of a union is built on unity and not pitting the players against each other. So that was an interesting approach for the league. But we have about a week, maybe 2 weeks here for them to play with before you have to start talking about pushing the start of the season back even further.
Evan, how transparent do you think ownership is or is expected to be in sharing the financial information with the union? And in a sense, open up the books and let them have a look.
So the union requested financial documents from the league to back up the league's claims of its financial peril. The league responded on Friday with some of the documents, certainly not the whole thing, and probably you wouldn't expect the whole thing to be responded to. Seth Levinson, one of the game's top agents at Aces, the name of his agency, he told us on the record that basically, this is going to require some element of good faith, that the players are going to have to buy in to the owner's claims one way or another without fully vetting everything. And then the fear for the players becomes that good faith is not returned when you hit the winter, when free agency rolls around and arbitration, and a lot of guys can be non-tendered and therefore don't go through the arbitration process. They don't want to say, okay, we believe you, and then find out later on that essentially the league and the teams are acting to recoup their losses in a drastic way next winter.
Is there any I guess, doubt from the player side that Major League Baseball will lose money this year?
The stance going into these talks 2 weeks ago was that the union believes that the league will make money for every game played. The league clearly claiming we will not make money for every game played. And there's some nuance to that with the postseason, where a lot of the national media money is tied to the postseason, about $780 million or so. And that's prorated for the 82-game season would be postseason money, and about $555 million is regular season. So there's clearly more money in the postseason. Whether the union today, right now, newly looks at that topic differently, whether it believes they will make money or have changed their minds that they will not make money no matter what, I can't say. But the heart of the argument is, might end up being a little different, where there's this clause in the thing about economic feasibility, that the owners don't have to start the season without a discussion about economic feasibility. This is where it's a can of worms. What does that mean? If you lose less money by playing games but ultimately still lose money, is that feasible? Those are the kind of discussions that this lovely labor topic opens up.
Well, Evan, I want to ask you about something you sort of just touched on a moment ago. And the more I read today, different articles and different websites and everything coming out on Twitter this afternoon, it seems to be becoming a bigger and bigger part of this picture. And that's this, that it seems like this is about a lot more than just a half or three-quarter season this year. How big a priority has protecting the offseason and the free agent market become right now?
Well, that's to be seen. If the players indeed make a counter proposal, that's one of the things that some agents believe would be wise to include in there, or some sort of provision saying a team can't cut salary beyond X amount, something where you modify or get rid of the qualifying offer system, that compensation system that makes big market teams less likely to sign players because they don't want to give up the draft picks. So there are ideas out there about what the players could do to attempt to protect the long term. But it becomes very tricky, because if you ask for something long term, MLB could easily turn around and say, no, we value that at, let's just say, $1.5 billion. And all we're looking for right now is $300 million or $400 million in return. So it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. That doesn't mean eventually this negotiation can't get there. For now, the bigger question is, will the players accept any sort of immediate-term pay cut? Or would they say, maybe we'll do a deferral for next year? We still don't have the near-term figured out. That's why the long-term becomes a little harder to deal with.
Evan, what are the next steps? Do we expect to hear something or a proposal from the players to the teams in a certain amount of time, 24 hours, less? What's the next step?
The only next step I can definitively say right now is that the union needs to talk to the players. Presumably at that point, you get a response to the league, be that we're going to make a counter proposal or no, you've got to send us a new proposal. But that's all we know at this moment. When that conversation with players takes place, your guess is as good as mine. Time is somewhat of the essence here. They've only got a couple weeks, as I said previously, before you start having to think about pushing your expected start date back a bit. So they can't dawdle too long. I would imagine in the next couple of days they're talking to players, and they're already talking to players tonight.
We're visiting with Evan Drellick from The Athletic, talking about Major League Baseball and the Players Association's negotiations on getting the 2020 season started. You know, Evan, one of the things that has been thought of as being one of the negotiating tools for the players, because they get paid on a per-game basis, is potentially playing a longer season than what's been suggested at either 78 or 82 games. How likely is that to be part of a negotiating strategy for the Players Association?
You know, I initially did not think that that would be something the players would want, feeling like the fear of the virus kicking back up in the fall and the winter months would be something that affects both sides, that neither side would necessarily want to drag it out. That said, in recent days, it became very clear to me that indeed the players' side would have interest in having as long a regular season as possible, because at least under that March agreement, under everything we're operating under right now, they are paid per game. So that might be something that comes in a counter proposal, that the players attempt to make this work by saying, we're not going to play 82 games, we'll play 110 games, and then you adjust the dollars however it might be. But to this point, there's nothing that I'm aware of impacting that. You know, it's not like today the league said, to my knowledge, let's play 110 instead of 82, but that might be coming.
Evan, with that, and another thing this evening, the Boston Globe is reporting that in addition to the reductions in salaries that were suggested, which would be about, I think, a third of what the prorated contracts would be, Major League Baseball did not propose an added round of playoffs into it. We've heard a lot of discussion about this idea of going to a 14-team postseason this year. Are they holding back as part of this? Because I know there had been some speculation about that postseason money perhaps funding some of the deficiency in the contracts if a negotiation were to occur where the players took a pay cut beyond just the prorated salary.
So the only thing I know of the postseason in the arrangement today, and I'm sure the Globe information is correct, the only thing I know of it is that the league was proposing an increased share for the players in the postseason. And the union was looking at that as saying, yeah, you're giving us a little bit more money there, but on balance, we're still going to lose a lot. The argument that they would make more money from an expanded playoff is correct. The owner counterpoint there is that they're going to have to make good on these national TV deals they have right now, where your postseason partner also has some regular season games. You can't, even if you're getting, let's say it's another $500 million, $300 million from an expanded postseason, in some ways the owners would basically be saying, this is already spent money because they've already paid us for games that aren't being played during the regular season and we're going to have to make good on it. So to look at it as a straight windfall for the owners probably isn't the most contextualized look at it. But that said, I was fully under the expectation, and I think everybody has been to this point, that it would be an expanded playoff because the more money they can get into the sport right now, the better.
Before we let you go, the other part of this, and really the more important probably than arguing over the money, is the health and safety protocols. I know that there were some reports today that maybe they're not in agreement as of yet on it, but has there been ground that's been made on the first Major League Baseball's proposal and then the Players Association's counter from last week?
So the league got back the union's comments. The union basically marked up the 67-page document. And the league also got back feedback from the teams as well. The feeling that was expressed to me earlier today is that this can be worked out eventually. It's not really going to be the sticking point. That doesn't mean right now it's inaccurate to say that there are differences. If there weren't differences, they wouldn't have sent back a marked up document with all these revisions. But as far as what's going to hold the thing up, the feeling is you get the money worked out, the health will prove to be collaborative. Eventually they'll get there. And then the better question, the biggest question to me is, if they start playing, can they finish? And nobody has that answer.
Right. Yeah, we're not going to get that answer until that date actually comes. That's one of the frustrating aspects of all of this. Evan, we appreciate the time. We look forward to reading your article with Ken Rosenthal in The Athletic either later tonight or tomorrow morning. Please stay safe, and we will talk again soon.
Thanks, Mikey. Thanks, guys.
All right. Evan Drellick from The Athletic joining us for a few moments. One of Gubb's greatest coming up up next. We'll talk about Game 2 of the 2001 World Series, which, Bert, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that is the Throwback Thursday broadcast on Fox Sports Arizona, correct?
It was also the game played between Games 1 and 3 that year.
Thank you, Bert.
Synergy is a lovely thing.
It's amazing that they taught you how to count. At Emerson.
I'm here for you. Wow, never leave your wingman.
What an education you got. Gubb's greatest.
Talk to me, Goose.
Next. This is the D-Bags BP Show. Time for another one of Gubb's Greatest as we visit with Greg Schulte about some of the biggest moments in Diamondbacks history and some of his favorite that he's had a chance to call. And game two of the 2001 World Series is probably overshadowed in that one. But, Greg, it was a tremendous game with two exceptional pitchers on the mound in the great Randy Johnson against one of the best postseason pitchers of his era, and Andy Pettit for New York.
Yeah, Randy 21-6 in the 2001 season, and Pettit was 15-10. And you had a matchup that was a dandy, to say the least. Diamondbacks got a run in the second inning on a double by Danny Bautista as Reggie Sanders was able to score. He had gotten a base hit. And so they had a 1-0 lead, and Randy, Mike, made that one stand up. He got a couple more later, but he was outstanding that night following Schilling's outing. Schilling in game would fanned 8 and 7 innings and a 9-1 victory. This particular ball game, Randy went the complete game, went the distance, allowed 3 hits, struck out 11, walked 1 in a Diamondback victory.
You know, you mentioned Danny Bautista, and there are a couple of big moments that he had in the postseason in 2001. What was it about Danny that allowed him to shine in those moments?
Danny Bautista getting his first start in the World Series, and there's a rocket into right center field. The ball will go to the wall. Reggie Sanders on his way to third. They're going to wave him around. Here comes the throw to the plate from Soriano. Sanders is safe. On to third goes Danny Bautista. 1-0 Diamondbacks. Every time Danny Bautista plays, something electric happens for this ball club.
He just had a great year, and he liked the ball up. He was a solid defender, played with a lot of confidence. He had a little swag to him. You know, he wasn't going to take any guff, and he just put a tremendous season under his belt. Got a chance to play and finally showed what he could do. I think, interestingly enough, Steve Finley didn't start that ballgame.
Right.
Bautista started that ballgame in center field. Finley came in late defensively, but Reggie Sanders was in right. Gonza was in left. You always think of Finley in the lineup, but on this particular night against Pettit, he was not in the lineup, and Bautista got the call in center, and it paid off for that first early run in the second inning.
It seems like every button that Bob Brenly pushed that year was the right one, doesn't it?
Yeah, and of course, New York fans will say, well, he didn't push the right button in New York when he brought in Kim, you know, and he left him in to play. But, you know, he'd done that the whole time. He had a good bench coach in Bob Melvin. He had a good coaching staff, guys like Chris Spire, and, you know, Bob Welch was a pitching coach, and he had a team that patrolled itself. When Bob needed to make a move, he wasn't afraid to make a move. And I think that's the biggest thing. He wasn't afraid to gamble. And, you know, he went by his gut a lot of different times, and it paid off. You don't win that many ball games, get to the World Series and win the World Series without a manager that makes some gutsy moves, and Bob Brenly made a lot of gutsy moves.
Getting back to game two, there was not a whole lot of action throughout no. most of the rest of it. I mean,
no, it was Pettit one of those bite-your-nail nights.
I mean, it is a 1-0 game, and it is getting late. And Pettit and Johnson are both on top of the game. What changed in the seventh?
Well, Pettit was out there again. He had Gonzalez to open the inning. Then Reggie Sanders hit into a fielder's choice. Bautista reached on a base hit. In fact, it was an infield hit. So they had two on, and Matt Williams came to the plate. Matt, prior to that at-bat, had a single. That was in the fifth inning. His first time up, he grounded a third. But he jumped on a Pettit pitch. It was the second pitch. He'd fallen behind on the count 0-1, and he hammered one to left. And Pettit and everybody, as soon as the ball left Matt Williams' bat, you knew it was gone. And typical Matt Williams, as soon as he hit the ball, he looked down to the ground and started to run to first base, did not look up until he rounded first base, and knowing, you know, by the reaction of the crowd that left the ballpark.
Sanders and Bautista, good speed on the bases. 2-1 out, 1-0 Diamondbacks in the last of the seventh inning. Pettit ready. And the 0-1. And a high drive! There it goes! 4-0 Diamondbacks! Matt Williams, a three-run homer! How about that? He crushed that ball!
Matt Williams played such an important role for the Diamondbacks in so many different ways over the course of his career, from joining him as a free agent in 98 all the way through the end of his career in 03. What was
Actually,
it was
a trade,
that?
Mike.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. It was the trade from Cleveland. That's right. Yeah. From Cleveland. Yeah. And that was the big acquisition right after the what was it? I'm trying to think. It was Travis Fryman, right?
Travis Fryman was a Diamondbacks that drafted Travis Fryman. I think Matt only spent that 1 year in Cleveland,
yes,
right?
That was the Jeff Kent trade, yeah.
And then, of course, he was living in Phoenix, and the Diamondbacks worked out a trade with the Indians, and they brought him over. They signed Jay Bell. That was their big free agent signing. And, you know, he joined Bell and Williams were joined by guys like Johnson and Schilling and Gonzalez and Womack and all those other guys. But, yeah, Matt was big. His name in Diamondback history is huge. And he came up really big in that particular ballgame. Without that home run, I mean, you're going to the eighth inning. It's still a 1-0 ballgame. Who knows what happens? But, Randy was superb. Williams got the big hit, and the Diamondbacks secured a 2-0 lead heading into New York.
Yeah, and Randy just 3 hits allowed in that entire game as he went the distance. And obviously he and Schilling were a huge story in that World Series. But this was his first crack at being in the World Series, his first World Series start, and it doesn't get much better than what he did.
6 innings, he set the side down in order, including the first 3. Struck out 7 of the first 9 he faced. He ended up walking Randy Velarde, in the 4th inning with 1 man out. Got out of that. Then Posada got a base hit to right field in the 5th inning. That was their first hit. They bunched 2 hits together in the 8th inning. And again, probably a little bit dicier situation had Matt Williams not homered in the bottom of the 7th to make it a 4-0 lead. But, Bob Brenly stuck with Randy, gave up back-to-back hits. He got Brocious on a called third strike. And then Soho, remember Luis Soho?
Yeah.
He came up as a pinch hitter and hit into a 5-4-3 inning and double play. And then Randy went perfect in the 9th inning, striking out his 11th batter and securing that win for Arizona.
Randy Johnson has been simply spectacular here tonight. And now he's trying to put the Yankees away. Diamondbacks 4, the Yankees nothing. Top of the 9th inning. 2 down, nobody on. 2 balls and a strike, Johnson to Derek Jeter. And a ground liner, right, it counts it. And Randy Johnson twirls a complete game 3-hit shutout to give the Arizona Diamondbacks a 2-0 lead in this World Series. Schilling and Johnson in the first 2 games go 16 innings, allow 6 hits and 1 run.
Up 2-0 in the World Series heading to New York.
Feeling good.
I was going to say the confidence level had to be pretty high at that point, right?
Yeah. But you know what? Even losing those 3 games in New York, I mentioned it in one of our previous shows that we did together here. You had to feel pretty good about Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling going to the mound in Game 6 and Game 7 back in Phoenix.
Yeah. The Diamondbacks obviously would go on to play 3 straight in New York. It didn't turn out quite as well as the first 2
Ugly games. They're not on my favorite list.
I noticed they were memorable games, that's for sure. I've always joked that the Diamondbacks won the World Series 6-1 that year, but or at least they should have. But that was an incredible incredible run, and obviously coming back for Game 6 and 7 with the Diamondbacks clinching their first championship. And that's another one of Gubb's greatest here on the D-backs BP show.
Diamondbacks baseball. Diamondbacks baseball. The D-backs BP show. Diamondbacks Radio Network.
By the way, Bert, you wanted to mention this. Obviously, we just heard Gubb's Greatest, Game 2 of the 2001 World Series, which will be Throwback Thursday on Fox Sports Arizona, and a very special 50-50 auction that night, correct?
That's right. Of course, Mike, it was Memorial Day over the weekend, so the 50-50 this week is benefiting Folds of Honor.
Yesterday.
Which is an organization that supports the families of those who have served. The raffle runs through Thursday night. As you mentioned, Thursday night's Throwback Classic on Fox Sports Arizona, Game 2 of the 01 World Series. And Fox Sports Arizona, by the way, has released the reunion of the 2001 guys on their YouTube page. So Gonzo's on there, Randy, Beebe, Womack, Finley, everybody on there. And before they play the game, or replay the game, I should say, on Fox Sports Arizona, Diamondbacks Virtual Engagements is back. So you've got the Gubna, Greg Schulte, and Randy Johnson, a special Q&A Thursday night, right before you watch Game 2 on Fox Arizona. So there's a lot going on there Thursday.
There'll be a lot of answers to a few questions.
Literally
on
the
that,
beauty so. Of Randy is you only have to ask him one question.
That is literally
– put a nickel in him and let him go.
Yeah, that, the is big literally, that is literally a Q and an A.
Leo, I like what you've done there. Nice
hour
work.
Later. We have been spending a lot of time on this program talking about some of the stuff that the Diamondbacks have continued to do in the community. It's something we've featured on the D-backs BP show over the last several years, and if you've listened to that, then our next guest is no stranger to you. She is the Senior Vice President of Corporate and Community Impact for the Arizona Diamondbacks. Debbie Castaldo is on the line with us. Hi, Debbie. How are you? Everybody safe and sound at your house?
Everybody is safe and sound at my house. I miss you guys so much. I can't believe it. I'm so glad to be on with you.
Hi, Deb. It's weird not seeing you because you're always running around Chase Field organizing 90 different things at once, all of which relate to the community. And how are you spending your time now with no games and nothing really concrete to do every day? I know you're really involved in the community, but I imagine it's in different ways right now.
It is. You know, we did during the first two or three weeks we were at home, we were completely focused on figuring out what was going to happen to families in our community that were losing their jobs and that were facing really food insecurity and financial insecurity. And so we spent a lot of time talking to organizations statewide, figuring out who was going to be able to step up to the plate and help families that were all of a sudden finding themselves without rent or food. And that was when we gave away our first $500,000. Was to really provide food and supplies for the four major food banks that take care of really the four corners of the state, and then a bunch of other smaller nonprofits in between that were going to step up right away and make sure families would not go without food.
That's one of the most impressive things about this organization, and Debbie, you're obviously a huge part of it, but right from the start, I don't think there was any doubt that we were going to be active in helping and reaching out to people, and it's so I'm sure you were quite busy, but had no doubt that you were still going to be in a position to do a lot of good for a lot of people.
Yeah, and you know, it's hard. I mean, you have to assess really who can rise at that point, who has the resources, who can handle that type of food, who has access to food, who can expand their efforts to make sure they can get drive-through food distribution set up. And we were just so impressed by the organizations we built relationships with. And all of a sudden you see massive food distributions happen, which give people in our community immediate relief and immediate comfort that maybe they'll get through this okay. And it's a brutal time and a tough situation for families, but we really did want families in our community to be okay and to be able to find food and water and get a little bit of financial help. And so really lucky to have a lot of great partners and an owner and an organization that really does care. So
yeah, you know, Debbie, and one of those groups that I know you guys have done a lot of work with is the Boys and Girls Club. And just recently, one of the newest Diamondbacks, and Stephen Vogt, got involved. Well, can you tell us a little bit about how he was involved with that group and what you've seen with the Boys and Girls Club and what's got to be a trying time for so many families that really lean on that organization for support?
Yeah, so the Boys and Girls Clubs of the big Metro Phoenix area now, which is old Metro Phoenix and West or East Valley combined, so they're one big group now, and they actually chose to stay open during this time to, in particular, to provide childcare for first frontline workers, first responders, teachers, those that are working in hospitals. And when Stephen Vogt arrived in Arizona and bought his house, he was in touch with me immediately and said, hey, I want to get involved in Little League and I want to get involved in just a whole list of things. Reminds me a lot of Eduardo Escobar and just, I want to get out, I want to do, I want to connect. Yeah. And so right away, I explained to him that the UX Boys and Girls Club is not far from where he lives. And he said, well, I got to do something until I can get out and meet the kids and play with them. What can I do? And I said, well, they're eating, you know, regular lunches and they've got some interesting things. And so he partnered up with Chick-fil-A and has provided a hot lunch at our D-backs Boys and Girls Club every Friday for the last couple of months. And the kids think it's the coolest thing ever. And so I know he can't wait to get out there and play with them. But until then, he wanted them to have yummy food. And he said his kids love Chick-fil-A. So he knew that our kids at the club would love Chick-fil-A as well.
Deb, that's one thing that always stands out to me with the Diamondbacks, and every major league team has players who are involved in their communities, but on our ball club, it seems like, as you just mentioned, they're proactive about it. They come to you with ideas and want to get involved, don't they?
Yeah, he and his wife, Alyssa, emailed last week and said, hey, Deb, we're ready to get on a call. We feel like it's time to do a little bit more. And so I had a great call with him last week. And we've got a couple of new things coming up with him. He's phenomenal at virtual engagements. So he did one with all of our little leaguers a couple weeks ago. And then he was our first virtual engaged visit to the hospital at Banner Cardin Children's. So we walked him around on an iPad, and he went room to room and visited all the kids on an iPad. And it's just, he's a tremendous daddy. And when you're a dad, you sort of have that kid language, and did an unbelievable job hanging out and visiting with the kids. So he's a special one for sure.
That's great. We're visiting with Debbie Castaldo, who's the Senior Vice President of Corporate and Community Impact for the D-backs. I know that this has been a very challenging time for a lot of educators. We have a teacher that lives across the street from us, and I think he probably spent more time figuring out how to use Zoom than he did actually building lesson plans so he could try and teach. Obviously, the Most Valuable Teachers Program is something that's been very big for the D-backs and the Community Fund. What can you tell us about where that stands right now as educators are being tested in trying to keep the attention of their students while they're at home?
Boy, that's for sure. Listening to my 16-year-old son's teachers trying to keep those boys focused on calls all day was insane. And these teachers are definitely heroes. So we wanted to actually ramp up our efforts to give the community a chance to just say thank you to incredible teachers that were figuring it out, whether that's how to get kindergartners and first graders on a Zoom call every day, thanks to mom and dad, or to keep kids engaged, to the teachers that have done drive-by birthdays and drive-by help with math problems and history homework. The stories that we received for nominations were incredible. So last month, we awarded our 10 MVTs for April, and then sometime this week, we'll announce our MVTs for May. And just such thanks and kudos to these teachers who I have so many friends as well, and they almost, you know, it's kind of that I survived time, and then the worry of what's going to happen in the fall and how do they prepare just in case. Now we're going to be back online again.
Now, that's fantastic. I know it's obviously there's some donations and which the financial help is all is fantastic. But I also know there's man hours that you put in. There's volunteer. There's employees going out. They're helping. You've had programs where you're help feeding the hospital workers in the hospitals, the frontline workers. So tell us some more about those programs.
Yeah, so, you know, when we put out the all call to with our announcement of how much we were going to give to the food banks, I put out an all-employee email and just said, hey, come pack boxes with me. Like, let's get together as employees. We miss each other, and let's go pack boxes at St. Mary's Food Bank. I guess who was first in line to come help and has gone with me every single week with Deb. We were out there, and that's the wizard, Mike Hazen. That guy is an unbelievable human being. He was out there with me every single time packing food, along with dozens of other DBEX employees, many that went on their own. Some have gone out of his groups. And now you really get to see how an organization like St. Mary's is putting that together. And we've worked really hard with our hospital partners, you know, knowing that they're on the front line. We've delivered a lot of different food from a lot of different partners. Just last week, I delivered a Cold Stone ice cream to one of the Banner hospitals just to thank you, some nurses and those folks from a patient who had been there and said they had taken such great care of her. Would I deliver some ice cream? So I went and bought some Cold Stone ice cream and took it down just to say thank you. And it's those little things that are keeping our healthcare workers going. But both Stephen and Eduardo both gave large gifts, and we were able to buy $20,000 in meals to provide food for all of the Banner hospitals, all of the Dignity hospitals, as well as those that are at the VA. You know, they're working 12-hour days and can't really get off to go get food. So we were able to buy them some food and help out as well.
That's really
Deb,
incredible.
One thing I think that's so interesting about your job is that you, on a day-to-day basis, when things are quote-unquote normal, you touch and interact with so many different sort of sections of the organization. You know, we're the broadcasters. We have our little area, and baseball ops has theirs, and community involvement has theirs. But you're sort of going through every department. And as you've done this over Zoom and indirectly, and given the circumstances that we're all under right now, what have you learned about the Diamondbacks as an organization that maybe you didn't know, if there's anything at all that you haven't learned by now?
Yeah, I think the thing I've heard most often during this is, how can I help? What can I do? You know, where can I still go volunteer? I have a little bit of time today. Is there anything I can do to help your group? And I think that's probably been the most important. You know, we all slowed down just enough to take a breath and sort of examine who we are and what we do. And I think everybody has found a little bit of time to give back. The folks that showed up and volunteered to pack food boxes every week are people that are traditionally really busy and just don't have the time to get out and spend 2 to 4 hours packing food boxes. And they were there week after week after week. They put it on their schedule and they showed up, and it was our time to get together and talk and sort of, you know, hope for the future that we're going to be back playing ball soon. And the other one that's blown me away is social media. Boy, if we weren't aware before of the power and the role that social media and, you know, the internet was going to have in our lives, kudos to Kyle and the team who have just really stepped up and been phenomenal at putting out creative content and interesting things to do and interact with fans. It's really actually been a lot of fun. These virtual calls are amazing. Who would have ever thought we would pull these off in the way that we're doing them? And it's just amazing.
Oh, that's great stuff. If folks want more information, dbacks.com/community is where the D-Backs Give Back program is located. Debbie, thank you so much. It is really good to talk to you. We miss seeing you, too. Please stay safe. We hopefully will see you at the ballpark soon. Fingers crossed.
I hope so. You guys, too. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks Deb.
Debbie Castaldo, Senior Vice President of Corporate and Community Impact for the Diamondbacks, joining us for a few moments. Thanks to her. Thanks to Evan Drellick from The Athletic for joining us today. And, guys, it's we've only got about a minute left, but this is a pretty important week for Major League Baseball and the Players Association. I don't want to sugarcoat it. This is where a lot of headway needs to be made in order to get a financial deal done, Bert.
Yeah, they want to have this thing wrapped up right by roughly – there's no hard – deadline. There's no hard cap in a sense, but I think June 1st, from everything I've read, has been the target date to get some sort of agreement in place, right?
Yeah, I think, and Leo, that's to get guys in camp early enough to be able to be ready for a season around July 1st. Now, these dates are flexible. We don't even have a 2020 schedule. They're a little bit flexible, but they want to try and play a representative season.
Well, especially if it's still up in the air on if players want more than 82 games, so... Mm-hmm. I know one thing. Next week's BP show is going to be interesting.
Yes. About time.
When isn't it? Come on, Leo. I'm disappointed in you.
So you're not going to want to miss next week's show. I'm telling you.
Technical director tonight has been Luke Robbins.
It's a hard out.
Our producer engineer is Leo Gilmartin. For Steve Berthiaume, the television voice of the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Three,
I'm Mike Thurman. Thanks for joining us on the D-Backs.
Good night, everybody. Show.